Snow Falling on Cedars, Disc 4.
At the start of the strawberry season, at 5:30 in the morning, Ishmael saw Hatsue on the South Beach wood path underneath Silent Cedars. They were both of them going to work for Mr. Nita. He paid better than any berry farmer on the island, for 35 cents a flat. He walked behind her, his lunch in hand. He caught up and said hello. Neither said anything about their kiss on the beach 2 weeks before. They walked the path quietly, and Hatsue suggested there was a chance they'd see a black-tailed deer out feeding on fern tendrils. She'd seen a doe the previous morning. Where the path met the beach, the madrona trees leaned out over the tidal water. Slender and sinuous, olive-green, mahogany-red, scarlet and ash, they were weighted with broad, gleaming leaves and velvet berries and shaded the beach stones and mudflats. Hatsue and Ishmael flushed a roosting blue heron with feathers the hue of beach mud. It squawked once and, elongated wingtips wide, graceful even in sudden flight, crossed Miller Bay at a soaring angle to perch in the dead top of a far tree. The path looped around the head of the bay, then down into a swale known as Devil's Dip. Ground fog shrouded its thimbleberry and devil's club, such was the clammy, low wetness of the place, then climbed among cedars and the shadows of spruces before descending into Center Valley. The homesteads here were old and productive ones. The Andreasons, the Olsons, the McCullys, the Coxes. Oxen had been used to cultivate their fields, descendants of the oxen brought to San Pedro in the old log-skidding days. They were enormous, pungent, and hoary beasts. And Ishmael and Hatsue stopped to stare at one, rubbing his hindquarters against a fence post. At Nita's farm, the Canadian Indians were already busy when they arrived. Mrs. Nita, a small woman with a waist no larger than a soup tin, darted up and down the rows like a hummingbird beneath her straw picking hat. Her mouth, like her husband's, was full of gold fillings, and when she smiled, the sun glinted in among them. In the afternoons, she sat beneath a canvas umbrella with a pencil between her fingers, her accounts laid out on a cedar crate before her, one palm laid against her forehead. Her handwriting was impeccable. Small, soft, and elegant numbers filled the pages of her account book. She wrote with the quiet deliberation of a court scribe, sharpening her pencil often. Ishmael and Hatsue went their separate ways to pick among their friends. The farm was so large that a leased, battered school bus carried workers to its dusty gate at the height of picking season. An aura of manic purpose hung over the fields, for in them went forward a gleeful harvest performed by children only just freed from school. San Pedro children delighted in their field toil, in part because of the social life it provided, in part because it furnished the illusion that a job had been included in the summer's proceedings. The rich heat, the taste of berries on the tongue, the easy talk, and the prospect of spending money on soda pop, firecrackers, fishing lures, and makeup all seduced them toward Mr. Nita's. All day, the children knelt beside one another in the fields, hunkered down close against the earth beneath the heat of the sun. Romances began and ended there. Children kissed at the verges of fields or walking home through the woods. Ishmael, from three rows off, watched Hatsue at her work. Her hair soon came loose from its arrangement, and a sheen of sweat appeared against her collarbones. She picked deftly and had a reputation for speed and efficiency. She filled two flats in the time it took other pickers to fill one and a half. She was among friends, a half-dozen Japanese girls, squatting in the rows together, their faces shrouded by straw hats, and would not acknowledge that she knew him when he passed her with his own flat mounded high. He passed her again with his emptied flat, and saw how intent she was on her picking, never hurrying but never stopping. He squatted again in his spot, three rows distant, and tried to concentrate on his own work. When he looked up, she was sliding a berry into her mouth, and he stopped to watch her eat it. Hatsue turned and met his eyes, but he could not discern in this her feelings. And it seemed to him wholly an accident. She meant nothing by it. Looking away, she ate another berry with no embarrassment, slowly. Then, adjusting herself on her haunches for a moment, she went back to her methodical work. Late in the afternoon at about 4:30, heavy clouds shadowed the strawberry fields. The clean June light went softly gray, and a breeze came up in the southwest. It was possible, then, to smell the rain coming, and to feel the cool pause before the first drops fell. The air turned thick. Sudden gusts caught the cedars at the edge of the fields and flailed their tops and branches. The pickers hurried their last flats in and waited in line while Mrs. Nita put marks beside their names and paid them from underneath her umbrella. The pickers craned their necks to watch the clouds and held their palms out to check for rain. At first, just a few drops raised tiny wisps of dust around them. And then, as if a hole had been punched in the sky, an island summer rain poured hard against their faces. And the pickers began moving toward shelter of any kind, the doorway of a barn, the inside of a car, the berry storage sheds, the cedar woods. Some stood with flats held over their heads and let their picked strawberries catch the water. Ishmael saw Hatsue cross the Nita's upper fields and slip into the cedar woods going south. He found himself following, slowly at first, letting the rain pound him as he moved through the strawberries. He was already soaked, so what difference could it make? The rain was warm and felt good on his face. And then he was trotting through the forest. The South Beach Trail, with its canopy of cedars, was as good a place as any in a rainstorm. And he wanted to walk at home with her, saying nothing if that was what she desired. But when he caught sight of her below the McCulley's farm, it occurred to him to slow to a walking pace and follow along at 50 yards. The rain would cover any noise he made, and besides, he didn't know what to say. It would be enough merely to see her, as it had been in the fields or when he'd hid behind the cedar log and watched her fold her family's laundry. He would follow along behind, listening to the rain pelt the trees, and watch her wind her way home. Where the trail hit the beach on Miller Bay, there was a wall of honeysuckle just past Blossom, salmon berries hanging in among it, and a few last wild roses blooming. Hatsue cut into the cedar woods. Ishmael followed her through a dell of ferns where white morning glory blossoms dotted the forest floor. A fallen cedar log hung with ivy bridged the dell. She slipped under it and turned up a side path that followed a shallow creek where 3 years before they'd sailed driftwood boats together. The path made three bends, and then Hatsue crossed the water on a log, hiked halfway up the cedar hillside, and ducked into the hollow tree they'd played in together when they were only 9 years old. Ishmael squatted beneath branches in the rain and watched the tree's entry for half a minute. His hair hung wet in his eyes. He tried to understand what had brought her here. He himself had forgotten about the place, which was a good half mile from his home. He remembered now how they'd packed moss underneath their legs and lolled in the tree looking up. It was possible to kneel, but not to stand, though on the other hand, the room inside the tree was wide enough to lie down in. They'd gone there with other kids and imagined they were hiding out, sharpening alder sticks with pocket knives to be used in their defense. The inside of the tree had been filled with a stock of arrows to be used in a fantasy battle at first, then in a battle fought amongst themselves. From twine and yew wood, they'd made miniature bows. They'd used the hollow cedar as a kind of fort and run up and down the hillside shooting at each other. Ishmael squatted there, remembering playing war on this hillside, and how that had ultimately driven the Syvertson girls away, and then the Yamada sisters. And then he saw that Hatsue was looking at him, from the entry of the hollow cedar tree. He looked back. There was no point in hiding. "You'd better come in," she said. "It's wet." "All right," he answered. Inside the tree, he knelt on the moss with water dripping beneath his shirt. Hatsue sat on the moss in her damp summer dress, her broad-rimmed picking hat beside her. "You followed me," she said. "Didn't you?" "I didn't mean to," Ishmael apologized. "It just happened, sort of. I was going home, you know what I mean? I saw you turn off, and it just happened, sort of. Sorry," he added. "I followed you." She smoothed her hair back behind her ears. "I'm all wet," she said. "I'm soaked." "So am I. It feels good, sort of. Anyway, it's dry in here. Remember this place? It seems smaller." "I've been coming here all along," said Hatsue. "I come here to think. Nobody else comes around. I haven't seen anybody here in years." "What do you think about?" Ishmael asked. "When you're here, I mean, what do you think about?" "I don't know. All sorts of things. You know, a place to think." Ishmael lay down with his hands propping up his chin and looked out at the rain. The inside of the tree felt private. He felt they would never be discovered here. The walls surrounding them were glossy and golden. It was surprising how much green-tinted light entered from the cedar forest. The rain echoed in the canopy of leaves above and beat against the sword ferns which twitched under each drop. The rain afforded an even greater privacy. No one in the world would come this way to find them inside this tree. "I'm sorry I kissed you on the beach," said Ishmael. "Let's just forget about it. Forget it happened." There was no answer at first. It was like Hatsue not to answer. He himself was always in need of words, even when he couldn't quite muster them. But she seemed capable of a brand of silence he couldn't feel inside. She picked up her straw hat and looked at it instead of him. "Don't be sorry," she said with her eyes down. "I'm not sorry about it." "Me neither," said Ishmael. She lay down on her back beside him. The green-tinted light caught her face. He wanted to put his mouth against hers and leave it there forever. He knew now that he might do so without regretting it. "Do you think this is wrong?" she asked. "Other people do," said Ishmael. "Your friends would," he added, "and your parents." "So would yours," said Hatsue. "So would your mother and father." "Yours more than mine," said Ishmael. "If they knew we were out here in this tree together..." He shook his head and laughed softly. "Your father'd probably kill me with a machete. He'd slice me into little pieces." "Probably not," said Hatsue. "But you're right, he would be angry with both of us for doing this." "But what are we doing? We're talking." "Still," said Hatsue, "you're not Japanese, and I'm alone with you." "It doesn't matter," answered Ishmael. They lay beside each other in the cedar tree, talking, until half an hour had gone by. Then, once again, they kissed. They felt comfortable kissing inside the tree. And they kissed for another half hour. With the rain falling outside and the moss softly under him, Ishmael shut his eyes and breathed the smell of her fully in through his nostrils. He told himself he had never felt so happy. and he felt a sort of ache that this was happening and would never again happen in just this way, no matter how long he lived. Chapter 9. Ishmael found himself sitting in the courtroom, where Hatsue's husband was on trial for murder. He found he was watching her as she spoke to Kabuo, and he exerted himself to look away. The jurors returned, and then Judge Fielding, and Carl Heine's mother took the stand. Despite living in town a full 10 years, she retained the look of a farmer's wife, stout, faded, and wind-worn. Etta adjusted her girth in the witness chair so that the hitching and sliding of her undergarments was heard. Heavy nylons, a girdle purchased in Lotte Opsvig's shop, a back brace prescribed by a doctor in Bellingham for the sciatica she attributed to her farm days. For 25 years, she had worked in all weather beside her husband, Carl Sr. Winters, with steam puffing from her mouth, she'd worn mud boots, a greatcoat, and a scarf over her head firmly knotted below her heavy chin. In fingerless wool gloves knitted late at night, sitting up in bed while Carl snored, she'd perched on a stool, milking cows. In summer, she'd sorted berries, cut runners, pulled weeds, and kept one eye on the Indians and Japanese who yearly picked on the Heine farm. She'd been born in Bavaria, still carried its accent, on a dairy farm near Ingolstadt. She'd met her husband when he came to her father's wheat farm near Hettinger, North Dakota. They'd eloped on the Northern Pacific to Seattle, she remembered eating breakfast in the dining car, where he worked for 2 years in a Harbor Island foundry and for one loading lumber on the waterfront. Etta, a farmer's daughter, found Seattle to her liking. She was a seamstress on Second Avenue and made Klondike coats at piece rate. The strawberry farm on San Pedro, where they visited at Christmas, belonged to Carl's father, a portly man. Carl had left it at 17, seeking adventure in the world. When his father died, he migrated back, bringing Etta with him. She tried to like San Pedro. It was damp, though, and she developed a cough, and her lower back began to bother her. She had 4 children and raised them to work hard, but the oldest went off to Darrington to set choker cables, and the second and third went off to war. Only the second, Carl Jr., returned. The fourth was a girl who, like Etta herself, eloped and went off to Seattle. Etta grew tired, gut-weary of strawberries. She didn't even like to eat them. Her husband was a true lover of the fruit, but Etta couldn't feel anything for it. To him, strawberries were a holy mystery, jewels of sugar, deep red gems, sweet orbs, succulent rubies. He knew their secrets, the path they took, the daily responses they made to sunlight. The rocks between the rows collected heat, he said, and kept his plants warmer at night than they would otherwise have been, but to this sort of thing she made no answer. She brought him his eggs and went to the barn for milk, threw feed from her apron pockets to the turkeys and chickens, scrubbed the field muck from the mudroom floor, filled the hog trough and walked through the pickers' cabins to see that they hadn't relieved themselves in pilfered canning jars. Carl's heart failed him one clear October night in 1944. She'd found him on the toilet, with his head against the wall, his pants clumped around his ankles. Carl Jr. was away at the war, and Etta took advantage of this circumstance to sell the farm to Ole Jurgensen. That gave Ole 65 acres in the middle of Center Valley. It also provided Etta with enough money to get by on if she was mindful of her pennies. Fortunately, this mindfulness accorded with her nature. It brought her the same depth of pleasure Carl had derived from nurturing his strawberries. Alvin Hooks, the prosecutor, he appeared more nimble than ever in her presence, was keenly interested in Etta's finances. He paced in front of her with his left elbow cradled in his right palm neatly and his chin resting on his thumb. Yes, she said, she'd kept the books for the farm. No, it had never been very profitable, but the 30 acres had gotten them by for 25 years. Better some years than others, she added. Depended what the cannery was paying out. They'd cleared their debts by 29. That helped, but then the Depression came along. The price of berries dropped. The farm all needed a rod bearing from Anacortes. The sun didn't shine every year. One spring, a touch of night cold ruined the fruit. Another, you couldn't get the fields to dry out, and the low-hanging berries rotted. One year, the fungus got you. Another, you couldn't keep the spitbugs down. On top of all that, Carl broke his leg in 36 and spent his time hobbling up and down the rows, chasing after posts or buckets he couldn't carry on account of his homemade crutches. Then he went and put 5 acres into raspberries and dumped money into that experiment, wire and cedar posts, labor to build trellises. It set them back until he figured how to cull the canes and train them to produce. Another time he tried a new variety, Rainiers, that wouldn't take because he used too much nitrogen. Lots of green, plants high and fluffy, but small, hard fruit. A piddling harvest. Yes, she'd known the defendant, Kabuo Miyamoto, for a good long time, she figured. It was more than 20 years since his family came to pick the defendant, his 2 brothers, his 2 sisters, his mother and father. She remembered them well enough. They were hard workers, kept to themselves mostly. They brought their caddies in, mounded up. She marked them off and paid out. They lived in one of the pickers' cabins at first. She could smell the perch they cooked there. She saw them some evenings, sitting under a maple tree, eating rice and fish off of tin plates. They would have their laundry strung between 2 saplings in a field of fireweed and dandelions. They had no automobile for getting about. She didn't know how they did it. In the mornings, early, 2 or 3 of their children went down to Center Bay with hand lines and fished from the pier or swam out to the rocks and tried for cod. She'd seen them on the road at 7 in the morning, coming home with their strings of fish or with mushrooms, with fern tendrils, butter clams, sea-run trout if they got lucky. They walked barefoot. They kept their faces down. All of them wore woven straw-pickers' hats. Oh, yes, she remembered them well. How was it she was supposed to forget such people? She sat in the witness stand, staring at Kabuo, and tears pooled in her eyes. Judge Fielding called for a recess then, seeing that her emotions had overwhelmed her, and Etta followed Ed Soames into the anteroom, where she sat in silence, remembering. Zenichi Miyamoto had appeared at her door at the end of his family's 3rd picking season. Etta had been at the kitchen sink, and from there, looking through the parlor, she saw him watching her. He nodded at her, and she stared at him, and then went back to her dishes. Then Carl, her husband, came to the door and spoke to Zenichi with his pipe between his thumb and forefinger. It was difficult to hear exactly what they were saying, so she turned the water off. Etta stood quietly and listened. In a little while, the 2 men left the doorway and went out into the fields together. From the window over the sink, she could see them. They would stop. One of them would point. They would move on. They stopped again, pointed, swept their arms this way and that. Carl lit his pipe and scratched behind his ear, and Zenichi pointed with his hat to the west, made a sweep, put his hat on his head. The 2 men walked between the rows some more, made the crest of the rise, and turned west behind some raspberry canes. When Carl returned, she'd put coffee on the table. "What did he want?" she said. "Land," said Carl. 7 acres of it." "Which 7? Carl had set his pipe on the table. "Due west 7, middle west 7. Leaves plots north and south. I told him better the northwest 7, if I was going to sell. It's hilly, anyway." Etta poured coffee for both of them. "We ain't going to sell," she said firmly. "Not in such times as these, when land is cheap. Not until better times come."
"It's hilly," repeated Carl. "Hard to work.
Good sun, bad drainage. Least productive acres on the property, he knows that. That's why he asked for it. Knows it's the only piece I'd think of letting go. He wanted the middle seven, Etta pointed out. Figured he might get a good 2 acres without your noticing it. Maybe, said Carl. Anyway, I noticed. They drank their coffee. Carl ate a slice of bread spread with butter and sugar. He ate another. He was always hungry. Feeding him was a challenge. So what did you tell him? She asked. Told him I'd think on it, answered Carl. I was getting ready to let 5 of them West Acres go to weeds, you know. They're so choresome to keep the thistle out of.
Don't sell, said Etta. You do, you'll regret it, Carl.
They're decent folks, answered Carl. You can bet it'd be quiet over there, nobody carousing or carrying on. Somebody you can work with when you have to, better than a lot of other people that way.
He picked up his pipe and fiddled with it. He liked the feel of it in his hand.
Anyway, I told him I'd think on it, said Carl. Doesn't mean I have to sell to him, does it? Just means I'm going to think.
Think hard, warned Etta.
She got up and started in clearing the coffee things.
She felt willing to push and pull about this. 7 acres was near 1/4 of the property, 1/4 of their holdings.
That 7 will be worth plenty more later, she advised. You're better off keeping a good hold to it.
Maybe, said Carl. I'll have to think about that, too.
Etta stood at the sink with her back to him. She did her dishes hard.
Sure be nice to have the money, though, wouldn't it? Carl said after a while. There's things we've been needing, and...
If you're going to get onto that, Etta told him, it won't do any good by me. Don't try waving new church clothes at me, Carl. I can get myself clothes when I need them. We're not such paupers as to sell to Japs, are we? For new clothes? For a pouch of fancy pipe tobacco? I say you'd better keep hold of your land. Keep a tight hold, Carl, and a new frilly hat from Lottie's won't change that. Besides, she added, turning toward him now and wiping her hands on her apron, you think that man's got a treasure chest or something buried in the field somewhere? That's what you think? You think he's going to slap it down all at once in front of you or some such like, do you? He doesn't have a thing but what we give him for picking and what he gets cutting firewood for Torsons and those Catholic people, who are they, on South Beach by the pier. He doesn't have it, Carl. He's going to pay up 2 bits at a time, and you're going to carry it for pocket change to town. Pipe tobacco aplenty, magazines to read. Your 7 acres is going to be swallowed up by the dime store in Amity Harbor.
Them Catholic people is the Heplers, returned Carl. Miyamoto don't do any work for them anymore, I don't think. Last winter he cut cedar bolts for Torgerson, made good money, would be my guess. He works hard, Etta. You know that. You've seen him in the fields. Don't have to tell you that. He don't spend none of it either. Eating sea perch all the time, big sack wholesale rice from Anacortes.
Carl scratched beneath his arm, massaged his chest with his thick, heavy fingers, picked up his pipe again and fiddled with it.
Miyamoto's live clean, he pressed on. You never been in their cabin? Person could eat off the floor in there. Kids sleep on mats. Somebody even been scrubbing mildew off the walls. Kids don't run around their faces all stained. Laundry all strung out neat with clothespins. Somebody carved. Don't wake up late, don't holler, don't complain, don't ask for nothing.
Like the Injuns do, put in Etta.
Don't treat the Indians like dirt neither, Carl said. Kind to 'em. Showed 'em to the latrine. Showed them new ones the trail to the salt chuck. Showed 'em the best place for butter clams. Now, said Carl, to me it don't make one bit of difference which way it is their eyes slant. I don't give a damn about that, Etta. People is people, comes down to it. And these are clean living people. Nothing wrong with them. So the question is, do we want to sell? Because Miyamoto, what he said, he's got 500 to put down now. 500. And the rest we can spread over 10 years.
Etta turned to her sink again.
If this wasn't Carl all over, she thought. Liked to wander in his fields, chat with his pickers, taste his berries, smack his lips, smoke his pipe, go to town for a sack of nails. Put himself on the board for the Strawberry Festival Association, judged the floats, helped barbecue the salmon. Got himself all involved buying up the new fairgrounds, getting folks in Amity Harbor to donate lumber and whatnot for the dance pavilion at Westport Jensen. Joined the Masons and the Odd Fellows both, helped out with the record-keeping at the Grange, stood around evenings up at the pickers' cabins, jawing with the Japs and taking pains with the Indians, watching the women weave sweaters and such, drawing the men out on the subject of the old days before the strawberry farms went in. Carl. Come end of picking season, he'd wander out to some old lonely place they'd told him about and look for arrowheads and bits of old bones, clamshell and whatnot. Once some old chief went with him. They came back with arrowheads and sat on the porch smoking pipes until 2 o'clock in the morning. Carl gave the man rum to drink. She could hear them going at it from the bedroom, the both of them getting tipsy. She lay there with her eyes open and her ears tuned to the night and listened to Carl and his chief do their rum, some horse laughs, all the while the chief telling stories about totem poles and canoes and an old potlatch he'd been to where some other chief's daughter had gotten married and the old chief himself had won a spear-throwing contest and the next day the other chief died suddenly in his sleep. Just like that he was dead and his daughter married and the others went and punched a hole in his canoe and stuck him in it and put it up in a tree for some god-awful reason. Edda had come to the door at 2 a.m. in her robe and told the chief to get on home. It was late. There were stars to walk by. She didn't like the smell of rum in her house. Well, she said to Carl now, folding her arms in the kitchen doorway where she knew she would have the last word. You're the man of the house. You wear the pants. Go ahead and sell our property to a Jap and see what comes of it. The arrangement, she explained at the behest of Alvin Hooks when the court had been called into session again, included a $500 down payment and an 8-year lease-to-own contract. Carl to collect $250 every 6 months, June 30th and December 31st, with 6.5% interest figured annually. Papers to be held by Carl, another set by Zenhichi, a third set for any inspector wanted to see them. The Miyamotos, this was back in 1934, said Etta, couldn't really own land anyway. They were from Japan, both of them born there, and there was this law on the books prevented them. Carl had kept the title in his own name, held it for them, called it a lease in case they got checked. She hadn't figured it. Carl had. She just kept track, was all. Watched the money come and go, made sure the interest was right. She didn't ever arrange no such thing. One moment, Judge Fielding interrupted. He smoothed his robe and blinked at her. Excuse me for interrupting, Mrs. Heine. The court has a few things to say about these matters. Pardon me for interrupting. All right, said Etta. Judge Fielding nodded at her, then turned his attention toward the jury. "We'll skip all the whispering at the bench," he began. "Mr. Hooks and I might discuss matters for a bit, but if we did, no doubt it would come down to this. I'm going to have to interrupt the witness in order to explain a point of law." He rubbed his eyebrows, then drank some water. He put down his glass and began again. "The witness makes reference to a currently defunct statute of the state of Washington, which made it illegal, at the time of which she speaks, for an alien, a non-citizen, to hold title to real estate. This same statute, furthermore, stipulated that no person shall hold title for an alien, a non-citizen, in any way, shape, or form. Furthermore, in 1906, I believe it was, the U.S. Attorney General ordered all federal courts to deny naturalized citizenship to Japanese aliens. Thus, it was impossible, in the strict legal sense, for Japanese immigrants to own land in Washington State. Mrs. Heine has told us that her deceased husband, in joint conspiracy with the defendant's deceased father,
entered into an agreement which, shall we say, was predicated on a rather liberal, albeit mutually satisfying, interpretation of these laws. They quite simply made their way around them. At any rate, the witness's husband and the defendant's father entered into a so-called lease agreement that concealed an actual purchase. A substantial down payment changed hands. False papers were drawn up for state inspection. These papers, in fact, along with the others Mrs. Heine has described, the ones her husband and his buyer held, were entered, as you may recall, as state's evidence in this trial. The perpetrators of all this, as Mrs. Heine has taken pains to point out, are no longer among us, so their culpability is not at issue. If counsel or witness feel any further explanation is required, they may inquire further, the judge added. However, he said, let it be known that this court is not concerned with any perpetrators of violations against our state's now, blessedly so, defunct alien land law. Mr. Hooks, you may proceed.
One thing, said Etta.
Yes, of course, the judge answered.
Them Japanese couldn't own land, said Etta. So I don't see how them Miyamotos could think they owned ours. They...
Mrs. Heine, said the judge, excuse me one more time. I apologize for interrupting, but I must remind you that Mr. Miyamoto here is on trial for murder in the first degree, that such is the focus of this court's concern, and that any contentiousness about legal ownership of land will have to be addressed in a civil court, madam. You will confine yourself, please, to answering the questions put to you.
Mr. Hooks, said the judge, proceed.
Thank you, Alvin Hooks replied. For the record, let me point out that the witness has attempted only to reconstruct the facts about ownership of her land in direct response to a question put to her in the course of examination. That furthermore, such information is vital to the state's case, and that a clear portrait of the agreement between the defendant and the witness will illuminate the defendant's motive for committing murder.
That's enough, said Judge Fielding.
You've made your opening statement, Alvin. Let's get on with it.
Alvin Hooks nodded and paced again.
Mrs. Heine, he said, let's back up just a moment. If the law, as you say, prevented the Miyamotos from owning land, what was the point of this sale agreement?
So they could make payments, said Etta.
The law let them own land if they were citizens. The Miyamoto kids were born here, so they're citizens, I guess. When they turned 20, the land would go over into their name. Law said they could do that, put it in their kid's name at 20.
I see, Alvin Hooks replied.
And they, the defendant's family, the Miyamotos, that is, had no children in 1934 who were 20 years of age, Mrs. Heine, as far as you know, ma'am?
Oldest one's sitting right there, said Etta, pointing a finger at Kabuo. He was 12, I believe, back then.
Alvin Hooks turned to look at the defendant as though he was uncertain who she meant.
The defendant? He asked. In 34?
Yes, said Etta. The defendant. That's what the 8-year lease was all about. When 8 years was up, he'd be 20.
In 42, said Alvin Hooks.
42, that's right, said Etta. November of 42, he'd be 20. They'd make the last payment December 31. The land'd go over into his name. That was going to be that.
Going to be? Said Alvin Hooks.
Missed the last payment, said Etta. Missed the last two payments, in fact. Never made them, the last two, out of 16 total.
She folded her arms across her chest. She set her mouth and waited. Nels Goodmanson coughed.
Now, Mrs. Heine, said Hooks, when they missed two successive payments in 1942, what did you do about that?
It took her a while to answer. She rubbed her nose. She adjusted her arms. She remembered how Carl had come home one afternoon with a posting he'd picked up in Amity Harbor. He'd sat at the table, smoothed it down in front of him, and read every word slowly. Etta had stood over him reading, too.
Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry living in the following areas, it said. And then it listed Anacortes in Bellingham, San Juan and San Pedro, a lot of other places in the Skagit Valley. She forgot the others. At any rate, it told the Japs they had to leave by noon on March 29th. They were to be evacuated by the Fourth Army. Etta had counted on her fingers. The Japs had 8 days, exactly. They could bring bedding, linen, toilet articles, extra clothing, knives, spoons, forks, plates, bowls, cups. They had to tie it in neat bundles and put their names on everything. The government would give them a number. The Japs could bring what they could carry, but no pets. The government said it would store their furniture. The furniture would stay. The Japs had to report to an assembly center at the Ampany Harbor Dock on March 29th, 8 a.m. The government would provide transportation.
By God, said Carl. He smoothed the bill with his thumb, shook his head.
Won't be pickers this year, replied Etta. Maybe get some Chinamen from Anacortes. The Japs aren't going to be around.
Plenty of time for that, said Carl. By God, Etta! He shook his head.
Carl took his fingers from the bill on the table. It rolled up of its own accord.
By God, he repeated. 8 days.
They'll be selling everything off, said Etta. Just you wait and see. All their knick-knacks, pots and pans, a lot of yard sales, you watch. That's what those people will do with their things. Sell them off as fast as they can to whoever'll take them off their hands.
People are going to take advantage, too, said Carl, still wagging his big head.
He sat with his forearms on the table. Soon, she knew, he was going to eat something, spread crumbs across her kitchen. He looked as though he was ready to eat, as if he was contemplating food.
It's too bad, he said. It ain't right.
They're Japs, answered Etta. We're in a war with them. We can't have spies around.
Carl shook his head and, heavy as he was, swiveled in his chair to face her.
We ain't right together, he told Etta flatly. You and me. We just ain't right.
She knew, indeed, what he meant by that. But just the same, she didn't answer. Anyway, he had said this sort of thing before. It didn't hurt very much. For a moment, Etta stood with her wrists against her hips, letting him know how she felt about matters, but Carl didn't look away.
Have some Christian compassion, he said. My grace, Etta, don't you feel nothing?
She went out. There was weeding to be done, and she had to fill the hog trough. She stopped in the mudroom, hung her apron on a hook, sat down to put her boots on. She was sitting there like that, struggling with a boot, worrying over what Carl had said, the two of them not being right for each other, that old thing, when Zenichi Miyamoto came to the door, took his hat off and nodded.
We heard, she said, about you people. Is Mr. Heine home, Mrs. Heine?
Miyamoto propped his hat against his leg, but then he shifted it behind his back.
He's here, said Etta. Yes.
She stuck her head around the mudroom door and called loudly for Carl.
Someone's here, she added.
When Carl showed, she said to him, You may as well talk about it right here in front of me. I'm a part of this.
Hello, Zenichi, said Carl. Why don't you come on in?
Etta pried her boots off. She followed the Jap into the kitchen.
Sit down, Zenichi, Carl said. Etta will get you some coffee.
He stared at her, and she nodded. She took a fresh apron from its hook and put it on. She filled the coffee pot.
We saw the posting, said Carl. 8 days just isn't near enough time. How can a body be ready in 8 days? It ain't right, he added. It just ain't right.
What can we do? Zenichi said. We will put boards with nails on our windows. Leave everything. If you will like, Mr. Heine, you can work our fields. We are grateful that you have sold them to us. Good 2-year plants now, most. We will have plenty berries. You pick them, please. Sell them to the cannery, keep what money. Otherwise they rot, Mr. Heine, and nobody gets nothing.
Carl began to scratch his face. He sat across from Zenhichi, scratching. He looked large and coarse. The Japanese man, smaller and clear-eyed. They were about the same age. But the Jap looked younger, 15 years younger at least. Etta put cups and saucers on the table, opened the sugar bowl. Pretty shrewd for openers, she thought. Offer the berries. They're worth nothing to him now. Real clever. Then talk about payments.
I'm obliged, said Carl. We'll pick them, then. I'm much obliged, Zenhichi.
The Japanese man nodded. He was always nodding, thought Etta. It was how they got the better of you. They acted small, thought big. Nod, say nothing, keep their faces turned down. It was how they got things like her 7 acres.
How are you going to make your payments if me and Carl's picking your berries?
She asked from her place by the stove.
It's not... Just hold on now, Etta, Carl broke in. We don't need to talk about that just yet.
He turned his attention back to the Jap.
How is everyone to home? He said. How's everyone taking it?
Very busy at home, said Miyamoto, packing everything, making ready.
He smiled. She saw his big teeth.
Can we help somehow? Said Carl.
You pick our berries. That is big help.
But can we help? Can we do something else?
Etta brought the coffee pot to the table. She saw that Miyamoto had his hat in his lap. Well, Carl was being a real gracious host, but he'd forgotten about that, hadn't he? The Jap had to sit there with his hat under the table like a man who'd wet his pants.
Carl will pour, she announced. She sat down, smoothed her apron. She folded her hands on the tabletop.
Let it sit a minute, answered Carl. Then we'll have our coffee.
They were sitting there like that when Carl Jr. barged through the kitchen door. Home from school already. 3:35 and home already. Must have run or something. Had one book with him, mathematics. His jacket was grass-stained, his face ruddy with the wind, a little sweaty, too. She could see he was hungry, like his father that way, ate everything in sight. There's some apples in the pantry, she pointed out. You may get one, Carl. Get a glass of milk and go outside. Somebody's here. We're talking.
I heard about it, said Carl Jr. Go on and get your apple, said Etta. Somebody's here, Carl.
He went. He came back with 2 apples. Went to the refrigerator, took out the milk pitcher, poured himself a glass of milk. His father reached for the coffee pot and filled Miyamoto's cup, then Etta's, then his own. Carl Jr. looked at them, the apples in one hand, the glass of milk in the other. He went on into the living room.
You go outside, called Etta. Don't you eat in there.
The boy came back and stood in the doorway. There was a bite taken out of one of the apples. The milk was gone from his glass. He was already near as big as his father. He was 18. It was hard to believe how big he was. He took another bite from the apple.
Is Kabuo home? He asked.
Kabuo just home, replied Miyamoto. Yes, he is there. He smiled.
I'm going over, said Carl Jr.
He walked across the kitchen and put his glass in the sink. He banged out through the kitchen door.
Come back for your school book, Etta called.
The boy came back and took his book up the stairs. He went into the pantry, got another apple, waved as he went by them.
I'll be back, he announced.
Carl pushed the sugar bowl toward the Japanese man.
Take some, he said. Cream, too, if you like.
Miyamoto nodded.
Thank you, he said. Very good. Sugar only, please.
He stirred in 1/2 spoon of sugar. He used his spoon carefully, set it in his saucer. He waited until Carl picked up his cup, then picked up his own and sipped.
Very good, he said.
He looked over at Etta and smiled her way, a little smile. That was all he ever gave.
Your boy is very big now, he said.
He was still smiling. And then he lowered his head.
I want to make payment. 2 more payment, everything done.
Today I have $120. Carl Sr. was shaking his head.
He put his coffee down, shook his head some more.
Absolutely not, he said. Absolutely not, Zenichi. We'll get your harvest in, see what comes of that July. Maybe then we can work out something. Maybe where you're going they'll have work for you to do. Who knows? It'll turn out. Point is, though, no way am I going to take your savings off your hands at a time like this, Zenichi. Don't even talk about that now.
The Jap put his $120 on the table. A lot of tens, some fives, 10 ones. He spread them out in a fan.
You take this, please, he said. I send more from where I am going. Make payment. Maybe payment is not enough. You still have 7 acres strawberries this year. Then December there is one more payment. You see, one more.
Etta folded her arms across her chest. She knew he wasn't giving his strawberries for nothing.
Your berries, she said. What can we figure? After all, nobody sets the price till June. All right, say you've got good plants, 2-year plants, like you say you do. Everything goes right. We get people in there weeding, no spit bugs, good sun. Everything comes out right. Berries come in, good crop. All right, after labor and what we put into fertilizer, maybe you've got 200 worth of berries in a good year, if the price is good. If everything goes right, but let's just say it's a bad year. An average year. Fungus gets them. Too much rain. Any one of a dozen things. Now we're talking about 100, maybe 120 worth of berries, okay? What then? I'll tell you what. It won't be enough to cover your payment. $250.
You take this, said Zenichi.
He made a stack of the bills, moved them toward her.
This $120. Strawberries bring 130. Next payment is made.
Thought you was giving the berries, said Etta. Didn't you come in here giving them away? Didn't you tell us to sell them to the cannery and keep whatever comes from that? Now what you want is 130.
She reached out and took his neat stack of bills, counted the money while she spoke.
130 on the risk they bring it, plus this here as an early payment, the risk in exchange for getting this March instead of us waiting on all of it till June. Is that what you came here hoping on?
The Japanese man blinked at her steadily. He said nothing. Didn't touch his coffee, either. He'd gone rigid, gone cold. She could see that he was angry, that he was holding it in, not exposing his rage.
He's proud, she thought. I just spit on him. He's pretending it didn't happen that way. Blink away, she thought.
Etta finished counting his money, set the stack of bills back on the table, and folded her arms across her chest again.
More coffee? She asked.
No, thank you, the Jap replied. You take money, please.
Carl's big hand slid across the table. His fingers covered the stack of bills and pushed it in front of the Jap's coffee.
Zenichi, he said, we won't take this. Don't matter what Etta says, we won't. She's been rude to you, and I apologize for that.
He looked at her then, and she looked right back. She knew how he felt. But it didn't matter very much. She wanted Carl to know what was up, how he was being duped. She wasn't going to hang her head. She stared back at him.
I am sorry, the Jap said. Very sorry.
We'll worry about this come picking season, said Carl. You get where you're going, you write to us. We'll get your berries in, right back, we'll go from there. We'll just play this by ear a little bit, far as I'm concerned. One way or another, you get your payments finished, maybe down the road somewhere, everything comes out like it should in the long run.
Everything comes out satisfactory, but right now you've got deeper things to think about. You don't need us bending your ear about payments, you've got plenty to do without that. And anything I can do, help you get your things all ready, you let me know, Zenichi.
I make payments, Zenichi answered. I find a way. I send you.
That's fine, said Carl, and put his hand out.
The Japanese man took it.
Thank you, Carl, he said. I make payments. No worry.
Etta watched Zenichi. it occurred to her that he had not grown old. She noticed this more clearly than ever. For 10 years he'd been working these very same fields. His eyes were still clear, his back was straight, his skin was taut, his belly remained lean and hard. 10 years he had worked in the same fields she had, and yet he hadn't aged a day. His clothes were clean, his head erect, his complexion brown and healthy. And all of this was part of his mystery, his distance from what she was. Something he knew about kept him from aging while she, Etta, grew worn and weary. Something he knew about yet kept to himself, bottled up behind his face. Maybe it was Jap religion, she thought, or maybe it was in his blood. There didn't seem any way to know. She remembered on the witness stand that Carl Jr. had returned that evening with a bamboo fishing rod. How he had looked to her coming through the door with his hair rumpled by the wind, how big and young, like a Great Dane puppy, bounding into her kitchen. Her son, a big young man. "Look at this," he'd said to her. "Kabuo loaned it to me." He began to explain it to her. She'd been at the sink peeling supper potatoes. He said it was a good rod for sea-run cutthroat. Split bamboo made by a Mr. Nishi, the ferrules smooth, silk-wrapped. Figured he'd go trolling with it, get Eric Everts or somebody, one of his friends, to take him out in a canoe. Rig it up with light tackle, see how it played. Where was Dad? He'd go show it to him. Etta didn't stop peeling her potatoes while she said to her son what she had to say. Take the fishing rod back to the Japs. They owed them money. The rod confused that. She remembered how the boy had looked at her, hurt and trying to hide it. Wanted to argue, didn't want to argue, wouldn't win and already knew it. The look of the defeated, his father's look. Big, plodding strawberry farmer. Subdued, pinned to the earth. The boy spoke like his father and moved like his father, but he had a broad brow, small ears. There was a set to his eyes, some of her in him. The boy was not all Carl's. Her son, too, she felt that. "You turn around and take it right on back," she'd said again and pointed with the peeler, and in this she saw now, on the witness stand, her feelings had not been wrong. He'd taken the rod back. Some months had passed. He'd gone to the war. He'd come on home. That Japanese boy had killed him. She'd been right about them all along. Carl, her husband, had been wrong. "They didn't meet their payments," she told Alvin Hooks. "Simple as that, didn't meet them. She sold the place off to old Jurgensen, sent their equity on down to them in California, didn't try to hold back their money, gave every penny back. She moved into Amity Harbor, Christmas time, 44. That was that, she'd figured. Looked now like she was wrong about one thing. You were never shut of people where money was concerned. One way or another, they wanted. And on account of that, she told the court, her son had been murdered by Kabuo Miyamoto. Her son was dead and gone. Chapter 10. Alvin Hooks skirted the edge of his table and resumed the slow, fluid pacing of the floorboards that had been part of his strategy all morning. "Mrs. Heine," he said, "in December of 44 you moved to Amity Harbor?"
"That's right."
"Your husband had recently passed away?"
"That's right, too."
"You felt that without him you couldn't work your land?"
"Yes."
"So you moved to Amity Harbor," said Alvin Hooks. "Where exactly, Mrs. Heine?"
"On Main Street," said Etta,
"up above Lottie Opsvig's shop." "Lottie Opsvig's, an apparel shop?"
"That's right."
"In an apartment?"
"Yes."
"A big apartment?"
"No,"
said Etta,
"just one bedroom."
"One bedroom above an apparel shop," said Alvin Hooks. "So you took a one-bedroom apartment, then. And may I ask about your monthly rent?"
$25, said Etta.
A $25 a month apartment, Alvin Hooks said.
You're still living there? You currently reside there?
Yes.
Still paying $25?
No, said Etta. $35. Price has gone up since 44.
44, Alvin Hooks repeated. The year you moved in? The year you sent the Miyamotos their equity and came to live in Amity Harbor?
Yes, said Etta.
Mrs. Heine, said Alvin Hooks, and stopped pacing. Did you hear again from the Miyamotos after that, after you sent them their money?
I heard from them, said Etta.
When was that? Alvin Hooks asked. Etta bit her lip and thought it over. She squeezed her cheeks between her fingers.
It was July of 45, she answered finally. That one there showed up at my door.
And she pointed at Kabuo Miyamoto.
The defendant? Yes.
He came to your door in 1945? To your apartment door in Amity Harbor?
That's right.
Did he call ahead? Were you expecting him?
No. Just showed up. Just like that.
Just showed up unannounced? Out of nowhere, as it were?
That's right, replied Etta. Out of nowhere.
Mrs. Heine, said the prosecutor, what did the defendant indicate was the nature of his business with you?
He wanted to talk about land, he said. Had a few things to say about my land I sold to all.
Exactly what did he say, Mrs. Heine? Can you remember, for the benefit of the court?
Etta folded her hands in her lap and glanced at Kabuo Miyamoto. She could see in his eyes, they didn't fool her, that he remembered everything.
He'd stood in her doorway, neatly dressed, his hands clasped, unblinking. It was July, and the heat in her apartment was unbearable. The doorway felt much cooler. They'd stared at each other, and then Etta had folded her arms across her chest and asked him what he wanted.
"Mrs. Heine," he'd said, "do you remember me?"
"Course I do," Etta had answered.
She hadn't seen him since the day the Japs left, more than 3 years before, in 42, but she recollected him clearly enough. He was the boy who'd tried to give Carl a fishing rod. The boy she used to see from her kitchen window, practicing in the fields with his wooden sword. He was the oldest of the Miyamoto children. She knew his face but didn't remember his name. The one her son used to hang around with.
"I've been back home 3 days," he'd said. "I guess Carl isn't home yet."
"Carl's passed on," replied Etta. "Carl Jr.'s fighting the Japs."
She stared at the man in the doorway.
"They're just about licked," she added.
"Just about," Kabuo had replied. He unclasped his hands and put them at his back.
"I was sorry to hear about Mr. Heine," he said. "I heard about it in Italy. My mother sent me a letter."
"Well, I told you people about it when I sent on down the equity," returned Etta. "Said in my letter Carl had passed on and that I'd had to go and sell the place."
"Yes," said Kabuo. "But Mrs. Heine, my father had an agreement with Mr. Heine, didn't he?
Didn't—" "Mr. Heine was passed away," Etta interrupted. "I had to make a decision. Couldn't farm the place myself, could I? I sold to all, and that's that," she said. "You want to talk about that piece of land, you're going to have to talk to all. I don't have nothing to do with it."
"Please," replied Kabuo. "I talked to Mr. Jurgensen already. I got back to the island just last Wednesday and went out to see what had become of the place. You know, have a look around. Mr. Jurgensen was out there, up on his tractor. We talked for a while about things."
"Well, good," said Etta. "So you talked to him?"
"I talked to him," said Kabuo.
"He said I'd better talk to you."
Etta folded her arms more tightly.
"Hmph," she said. "It's his land, isn't it? Go on back and tell him that. Tell him I said so. You tell him."
"He didn't know," said Kabuo. "You didn't tell him we were one payment away, Mrs. Heine. You didn't tell him Mr. Heine had—"
"He didn't know," sneered Etta. "Is that what all told you? He didn't know. Is that it? Was I supposed to say, 'All, there's these folks made a illegal agreement with my husband, hands over 7 acres to them'? Is that what I was supposed to say?" "He didn't know," repeated Etta. "Most ridiculous thing I ever heard. I'm supposed to tell someone's buying up my land there's an illegal contract muddling matters up? And what if I did, huh? Fact is, you people didn't meet your payments. That's a fact. And just suppose you'd done that to a bank round here. Just suppose. You don't make your payments. What do you think happens? Somebody waits real polite on you? No. Bank repossesses your land. That's what happens. I haven't done anything a bank wouldn't do. I haven't done anything wrong.
You haven't done anything illegal, the Jap replied. Wrong is a different matter.
Etta blinked. She stepped back and put her hand on the doorknob.
Get out of here, she said. You sold our land, the Jap continued. You sold our land out from under us, Mrs. Heine. You took advantage of the fact that we were gone. You...
But she'd shut the door so as not to listen.
Carl made such a mess, she'd thought. Now I have to clean it all up.
Mrs. Heine, said the prosecutor, Alvin Hooks, when she'd finished telling of these things, did you see the defendant thereafter? Did he approach you again about these land matters?
Did I see him?
Asked Etta. Sure, I saw him. Saw him in town, saw him at Peterson's, here and there. I saw him now and again, yes.
Did he speak to you?
No.
Ever?
No.
There was no further communication between you?
None I can think of, unless you want to call dirty looks a way of speaking.
And she glanced at Kabuo again.
Dirty looks, Mrs. Heine.
What exactly do you mean?
Etta smoothed the front of her dress and sat more erectly in the witness stand.
Every time I saw him, she insisted, there he'd be with his eyes narrowed at me, you know, watching, glaring.
I see, said the prosecutor. And how long did this continue?
Been going on ever since, said Etta. Never stopped. I never saw a sociable look from him, not once in all the times I saw him, always narrowing his eyes at me, giving me his mean face.
Mrs. Heine, said Alvin Hooks, did you ever have a conversation with your son about the defendant in this regard? Did you tell Carl Jr. that Kabuo Miyamoto had come to your door and argued with you about the sale of your family's land?
My son knew all about it. When he got back, I told him.
Got back?
From the war, said Etta.
A couple months later, about October, I think it was.
And you told him then the defendant had come to your door?
Yes.
Do you recall his response?
Yes, said Etta.
He said he'd keep an eye on it. Said that if Kabuo Miyamoto was giving me dirty looks, he'd keep an eye on him.
I see, said Alvin Hooks.
And did he?
Yes, as far as I know, yes.
He kept an eye out for Kabuo Miyamoto?
Yes, he did. He watched for him.
To your knowledge, Mrs. Heine, were the two of them on unfriendly terms? They were both fishermen. They shared that in common. They were, as you have said, neighbors in adolescence, and yet there was this dispute, this family dispute over land. So were they, the defendant and your son, on friendly or unfriendly terms from 1945 on?
No, said Etta.
The defendant wasn't no friend of my son's. Isn't that obvious? They were enemies.
Enemies? Said Alvin Hooks.
Carl told me more'n once he wished Kabuo would forget about his 7 acres and stop looking at me cross-eyed.
When you told him the defendant had given you dirty looks, your son reacted exactly how, Mrs. Heine?
Said he wished Kabuo would stop doing that. Said he'd have to keep an eye out for Kabuo.
Keep an eye out, Alvin Hooks repeated.
He saw some danger from Mr. Miyamoto?
Objection, cut in Nels Goodmanson. The witness is being asked to speculate as to her son's state of mind and his emotional status. He's...
all right, said Alvin Hooks.
Tell us what you observed, Mrs. Heine. Tell us what your son said or did. Was there anything to suggest he saw some kind of danger from Kabuo Miyamoto?
Said he'd keep an eye out for him, repeated Etta. You know, he'd watch out.
Did your son say he felt he had to watch for Mr. Miyamoto, that there was danger from him of some kind?
Yes, said Etta. He kept an eye on him. Every time I told him that man was glaring at me, that's what he said. He'd watch out.
Mrs. Heine, said Alvin Hooks, Do you think that the term family feud could be accurately applied to the relationship between your family and that of the defendant? Were you enemies? Was there a feud? Etta looked directly at Kabuo.
Yes, she said. We're enemies, all right. They've been bothering us over those 7 acres for near 10 years now. My son was killed over it.
Objection, said Nels Goodmanson. The witness is speculating as to...
Sustained, agreed Judge Fielding. Witness will confine herself to answering questions put to her without further speculation. I hereby instruct you jury members to disregard her last words. Witness's comment will furthermore be struck from the record. Let's move on, Mr. Hooks.
Thank you, Alvin Hooks said.
But I can't think of anything else I want to ask, Your Honor. Mrs. Heine, I want you to know that I appreciate your coming down, though, what with this weather we've been having. Thank you for testifying in a snowstorm.
He swiveled now on the toe of one shoe. He pointed a forefinger at Nels Goodmanson.
You're a witness, he said.
Nels Goodmanson shook his head and frowned.
Just 3 questions, he grumbled without getting up. I've done some calculating, Mrs. Heine. If I've multiplied correctly, the Miyamoto family purchased 7 acres from you for $4,500. Is that right? $4,500?
Tried to buy it for that much, said Etta. Never finished their payments.
2nd question, Nell said. When you went to old Jurgensen in 1944 and told him you wanted to sell him your land, what was the price per acre?
$1,000, said Etta. $1,000 per acre.
I guess that makes what would have been $4,500 into $7,000 instead, doesn't it? A $2,500 increase in the land's value if you sent the Miyamotos their equity and sold the land to old Jurgensen.
Is that your 3rd question? Said Etta.
It is, said Nels. Yes.
You done your math right. $2,500.
That's all, then, thank you, Nels replied. You may step down, Mrs. Heine.
This ends Disc 4.